Welcome to Coffee with Kim. I'm Kim Kelp, and every week you and I sit down with fascinating, smart, and talented leaders, CEOs, and founders so that we can copy their homework. If someone knows how to do something really well, I want to know what it is and exactly how they're doing it. Get ready for aha moments, gems of wisdom, and little known tips and tricks that we can steal and use in our own lives. If you want to join these conversations and ask these experts your own questions, no point in just me having all the fun. Join us on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern live over on LinkedIn.
Happy Day, friend. So good to see you. If you're joining us from here in the United States, I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday and it was filled with all of the good food and the loved ones and the chaos that the holidays bring. If you are not joining from the United States, well, you can still, you know, get all the chaos goodness with the holidays wherever you are, because there's no shortage of that. And because we are coming into holiday season, I really felt like it was important to dig in to the topic that we're all going to be hearing about for the next couple of weeks, which is joy, joy to the world. If you heard that in CVS starting in October, my heart is with you because it feels like they started Christmas exceptionally early this year. Maybe some would say too early. That would be me. A little early when we start blasting Joy to the World in CVS in October. I do love a good Christmas jam, but October is a little too soon for my taste. But as we kind of dig into the end of the year and reflecting on, you know, what we want to bring into 2026 and what we want to do more of and what we want to do less of, you know, one thing that I kept coming back to and was really excited to see, it's a topic that our friend Jen talks about all the time, which is really how to bring joy to the workplace. What does that look like? Is it even possible? I feel like for some people, you know, that's a big myth, is like, work equals like, bleh, crazy boss and I hate it. Like, is joy at work even a thing? And so I thought it was really fitting. And Jen has been talking about this subject for a very long time. Joy at work, kind of knowing yourself, Enneagrams, for any Enneagram lovers out there, I'm sure we'll get into that as well. And so I was really excited to see that Jen took a deep dive and decided to write a book all about this subject, which she talks about on her podcast and in her various speaking engagements. And that book, which is called Joyosity, How to Cultivate Intense Happiness in Work and Life, is out in just a few days. The hardcover comes out December 9th, I think. Although I listened to the podcast episode this morning and it said I was already out. So we'll have to clarify with Jen when it actually is coming out. But I hope wherever you are, Aaron and Jeff and James, can help me raise their caffeine glass of choice and welcome Jen to our coffee chat. Hey, Jen.
Oh, hey, so happy to be here.
It's such a joy to have you here. Yeah. Is the book out?
No. Yes and no. So,
yes and no.
You know, like, publishing is a super weird industry and I'm learning more and more. So technically the launch date is Tuesday, December 9th. However, right. One of my friends in Knoxville who ordered from Bookshop got her book yesterday. So I don't really understand, but technically the book comes out December 9th and pre-order bonuses are still available until December 9th. So, you know, I mean,
she got a little exclusive sneak peek.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh my God. Wait, hold it up again. Let's look at it, everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm so curious. I promise we'll get into everybody else's questions, but first mine. You do a lot of speaking on this subject. You have podcast episodes. You've been on podcasts. You've been on this show before, you know, sinking into this subject. Why a book? Why did you feel like, because everyone I talk to, books are a nightmare. I mean, a loving nightmare, but like they're a lot of work. The work doesn't stop once the book comes out. Like, it's just a big undertaking. It's like climbing Everest. So why a book?
Well, I'm never going to climb Everest. I don't even want to climb Kilimanjaro. So even though friends of mine do. So It's a great question because lots of people say, oh, I think I want to write a book. And writing is different than publishing. It's a whole thing. And I, especially as a speaker, get a lot of advice about, oh, you just need to write a book. You just need to write a book. And I just couldn't get my head around, as you just said, all of the work just to have a book. That did not feel valuable to me in any way, shape, or form. And I went to Disneyland with Bob Goff and a few others in what was called the School of Whimsy in November of 22. So 3 years ago, like just recently. And I'm on the raft between the mainland and what is, I think, now called Pirate's Lair. It used to be called Tom Sawyer's Island. And I'm talking with Jack Sparrow and Red, as one does at Disneyland, and one of the coaches. And in the School of Whimsy, it was about dreaming bigger and doing these other things. And I'm in a lot of spaces like that. As somebody who likes to dream big, I help people do that. I do my own professional development. But at that moment, one of the coaches, his name was Tyler, asked me a question. I wish I could remember the question, but I cannot. And it just let me go, oh, now that's interesting. I could think about a book like that. And it very much made me consider I could write a book like Jen Whitmer writes. I could write a book the way I speak, the way I do things. I'm sure there was a song involved because that's who I am. But that just percolated for a long time of like, oh, I could write a book that expresses the concepts that I talk about all the time in a way that feels like me, that people who don't ever get the chance to sit in a keynote audience or coach with me could still access the material and could pour over it. They could digest it. It wasn't just so I had a book out in the world. And I think that was the difference that I needed. Maybe possibly some Disney magic that I needed.
I feel like the Disney magic always can just push anyone over the edge to really do anything.
Right.
When you're at the happiest place on earth, you're like, yeah, this seems like a great idea. Why wouldn't I do this?
It's absolutely.
I want to kind of say the elephant in the room, which I got one or two messages when we first posted about this, and people were like, is joy at work even possible? And they had other things to say, but I was like, I hate my job, and is joy even real? And, you know, I think that that's probably one of the things that you get pushback on a lot, but I really love your answer to this, which is, not only is it possible, it's your responsibility to kind of cultivate that and find that. And I'm curious, did that come from something that you witnessed? Was that something that you yourself had to walk through?
It's a great question. And I love this question because it welcomes the doubters. Like it's such a easy thing to dismiss. It's one of my deepest fears that people are going to be like, joy is just naive. Aren't you just Pollyanna out there? You know, toxic positivity. And I absolutely not. That is not what I am here to do. And my own personal experience really informed this work. So I was an assistant head of school for a kindergarten through sixth grade. Well, actually started 3-year-olds through sixth grade school. And I was the director of assessment and feedback. And so I was in charge of all the things people love: report cards, parent-teacher conferences, standardized testing, you know, the things people are like, yay. And I was like, why does this have to be so hard? What if we started with a different question? What if testing could be joyful? And so I just came up with that literally sitting in my office with the kids playing. We had a rooftop playground and I could hear the kids playing behind me. And that whole process started to show that not only could joy change how people felt about testing, because I mean, if you have kids of any kind, or if you remember standardized testing, it's not usually your favorite thing. And even as adults, when we have to go in and do any kind of the LSAT, you have to sit for the CPA exam, you have to sit for the MCAT, whatever it is.
I don't even like doing my eye exam, quite frankly, because it makes me feel like a loser. And you're like, can you read that? And I'm like, no, Rachel, the R looks like a B.
And so rather than just accepting that testing has to be stressful and awful, I was like, well, let's start with a different question. And what happened was not only did people come in, and I got a really great gift. I tell the story in the book, but there's a plaque over there that says Jen Whitmer, Director of Good Moods, that I got from a parent after testing. I was like, okay, so my theory was correct. It doesn't have to be terrible. But what she didn't know when she gave me that gift is I had already seen our testing scores, which were now in the top 25th percentile of the world, actually, because it was an international test. So the second part of my theory was we could bring joy into what is really, you know, the workiest work of school, like really nitty gritty yicky, make it joyful and get better results. And then we also had, about 2-3 years later, we were awarded the Blue Ribbon Award for our school, which is the highest academic honor that's based on testing and culture. So it was like, okay, joy works. And then we had a change of leadership, and this amazing, joyful place that I existed in turned into a toxic environment. And it was such a whiplash, such a terrible, awful experience that I thought was singular to me. And once I left the world of education, I started to realize, oh no, this is really common, that so many people at the least are experiencing dysfunction, and more people are experiencing toxicity. And in fact, just a couple months ago, I think it was in October, a study came out that said 80% of people think their workplaces are toxic. 80%. That's insane.
That can't be good.
So when I went through this and I got out and I was like, what is happening? And I went back to school because, you know, that's what teachers do. And so it's like, get another master's. This will solve all the problems. But I really started studying communication and culture, and that's what my master's was on. And I was like, okay, analyze this. What did we do that made a joyful culture that was more productive and more effective? What happened to destroy that? And that is where this really came from. So it's a lot of my own personal story, but then working with teams and leaders and organizations, helping them shift from difficult communication, from really friction, lots and lots of friction, and lack of productivity and engagement. All of those things are lagging indicators of a lack of joy. So that's my personal experience with it. And for the doubters in the room, I can give you a lot of statistics, but I think we all know that we want joy, right? I mean, we don't need a statistic for that, right?
1,000%. I feel like what happens in a lot of these, you know, toxic, by the way, workplaces, personal relationships, you know, it doesn't have to always be work related. And it's something, again, that you talk about, and our mutual best friend in our minds, Brené Brown, talks about is really, you know, that honesty can be kind, and
Absolutely. Really
being true is actually a gift to other people. And so one of the things that I really appreciated that you talked about in the book and talk about just in this work is the value of not only honest feedback, but helpful feedback. So honest feedback just saying like, well, Mark, the marketing presentation sucked. Like, well, that's not helpful because it doesn't really tell Mark how to improve. but if you have like honest and helpful feedback, that can really build a workplace or help to build at least your relationship to your boss, your superior, I don't know, your spouse, your kids, whoever's like around you from a personal standpoint too. Do you ever find that people struggle with like the honesty part or because you do want to spare people's feelings and you don't necessarily want to always give the honest feedback?
Yeah, because the honest feedback is vulnerable. It's exposing, not just to the person receiving the feedback, but to you. And so that fear is what keeps us from joy in so many aspects, let alone just honest communication. Our fear of vulnerability and exposure is what prevents us from joy. And I even had this conversation literally last night with my daughter, who is a sophomore at Belmont, and she is a leader. She just got elected to be president of one of the clubs there that she's a part of. And I'm so proud of her. And she was talking about this communication. First of all, the communication was over text. First of all, that's hard. And she was like, and I was like trying to go around it. And rather than just say, this is the thing, and somebody else comes in and go, it's this person's job. And I was just trying to be nice. And I love her. And I was like, I'm kind of with the second person, because nice clouds us and isn't always honest. And all of this, I mean, we didn't go into all of it because we were like walking the track and she, you know, but so much of us, so many of us were trained to be nice. And nice isn't usually helpful in the long run. You can be kind, clear is kind. You can be kind. I call it kind confrontation, which means being willing to face somebody. If you think of the word confront, it means with and face. So you face the front and you're with somebody in it and you're like, I'm here for you. I'm here with this and I am out for your good in the long run. That, I mean, some of the most helpful feedback I've ever received was probably not nice, but was incredibly kind. And that type of honesty around things that are about your behavior, not about your personhood, like your identity and belonging are not at stake, but here's behaviors we'd like to see change. That is incredibly helpful to people as a leader on your team. And even if it stings a little bit, you know, have you ever gotten that feedback that's a little ouch and amen? You're like, oh, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. But then you have an action you can do something with that actually changes things. It's really powerful.
Well, and it's really powerful to also figure out how you are going to go into these situations. So I forget what podcast I was listening to. Maybe it was like a Mel Robbins or something like that, or Jefferson Fisher or something. But they were talking about, you know, if you're going in to have a conversation that you already know is going to be hard because you're going to give this honest feedback and maybe you're uncomfortable or you're struggling with how to present it or whatever. They talk about kind of setting the scene when, first of all, exactly what you said, it should be face to face. Ah, these phones, I want to chuck them in the water. I mean, they're the worst. Stop texting people. Nobody understands how you're coming across as text. Stop with the emojis. I don't even know what half of them mean. Just enough. So get on a Zoom call or you know, be in person, I think, number one. But the second thing they talk about is actually just saying, this is going to be kind of a hard conversation, but it's important and we need to have it. And I thought that that simple sentence was brilliant because that's it kind of lets the other person know this isn't necessarily going to be fun. But it is very important and therefore we need to make time and space for it. And so what I took away from that too was really how important it was to prep myself. I think a lot of times we worry so much about the other person, like, oh, is Jen going to get mad or is Jen going to be offended or will Jen take the feedback well, that we almost forget to focus on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing I really appreciated about the book and kind of the topic areas, which is really kind of know thyself and what, how do you handle situations? And whether that is the Enneagram or however else you want to kind of work through your own personality traits, but how comfortable you are with the discomfort. And I'm wondering, do you think it's possible for somebody to get good at creating joy with other people when they haven't found it kind of first within themselves? Or you really have to start with you, I think.
Absolutely. I don't think you can create joy. You can't create something you don't have. You just can't. And I believe to my toes that you can't lead people places you're not willing to go. And
totally.
I like this. The subtitle of the book is Even If Things Are What They Are. So even if things are what they are the things that we cannot change. So there are very few things in the world that we actually have control over. Very few. We have this whole illusion of control. But the only one that we have the absolute most control over, as much as we can, is ourselves. And so I keep living, and I'm annoyed that I keep living that second subtitle of the book, even if things are what they are. Like, the original pub date of this book was October 21st. It was 2 days after my 50th birthday. It was going to be amazing. And we had a couple things early on. Like, I knew this back in June. And it was really hard to change that expectation because it really just was what it was. And I had to deal with the disappointment, know myself and know why I was disappointed, because joy doesn't come from being happy all the time. That's not what joy is. Joy is part of a radical acceptance of reality and then understanding how to deal with yourself and relationships and the circumstances to continue to create joy, because real joy has deep roots. And roots always form in the dark.
Oh, I love that. Roots always form in the dark. Ah, that's so good. I feel like whenever we get those little nuggets, it's one of the things that we have to like put on a post-it note. We love those and keep it handy when we have to.
I mean, how many do I have right now at my
I'm looking at 7 just on my computer screen. Yeah. So we have more than enough. And also, you know, we've started with 2 cups. There'll probably be more. Let's be honest. By the end of the day, there will be at least 3 or 4. So, you know, choose your cup on this adventure. I want to touch on this question from Jeff, which I think some people in the audience may or may not want to vocalize, but they also might be thinking it or know somebody that is thinking it. And that is, when you are around a team or a group of people or people at work who are feeling deflated. So we've heard about a lot of layoffs. Oracle, I think, had a huge round on Monday this week, but there have been layoffs, you know, globally for quite some time with, you know, the emergence of AI and how much stuff is going automated. How do you approach teams and executives who are dealing with this energy of, I guess, glass half empty, like this deflated sort of pessimistic view on what's happening?
Well, I have a two-part answer. So first, it's the people in the room. So Jeff's question, you know, the change in the energy of the team, they're feeling defeated. Whenever, again, back to that, when things are what they are, naming it. This is what is happening, being honest about the reality of it. And rather than, all right, people, let's just keep going forward, you know, which is kind of that, that makes people, a couple things people often feel like are being gaslit. Like, am I crazy for feeling this way? They start to feel that. Then they feel dismissed. Well, and if I feel dismissed, I already feel dismissed because now I feel disengaged because of this AI situation, or my friend lost their job and I have it. So I also have a little bit of survivor's guilt, but now I have more work to do. You know, all of those things are happening and they're no longer listening to whatever pep talk you just gave them because you're not living in the reality that they are. And so now they don't feel like they belong and they just continue to back up and disengage more. That is the cycle. So they become less productive. And so rather than glossing over it, because, you know, I'm a baker, I love to bake. If you ice a cake too soon, you just get crumbs everywhere in the icing. And that's what's happening when we do that. So take the time to let the metaphorical cake cool and honor that that's what's happening. Like, I can see your disappointment. I know that this is hard. This is a difficult time for all of us. We can pretend that we know what's going to happen next, but we actually don't. Here's what I do know. And then share what you do know about that, whether the way you feel about them, about the quality of their work, or what you do know is in the future, the immediate future of your company and organization. But don't gloss over those emotions and feelings. Letting people express them appropriately, either individually or as a team, is incredibly important because those emotions are in the room anyway. There's a whole chapter in Joyosity basically that says, let feelings in at the table because they're already there. And so allowing people to express those emotions is part of letting them go. Then you can start to say, okay, now what? what do we do to move forward? But you've let the emotions have their right place. So that is the first part of like changing the energy of the team is, first of all, acknowledging what the energy of the team is, that level of defeat and what they feel like. The second thing is, on a bigger level, I wrote this book for leaders, individuals, but also I feel deeply that joy is a rebellion. That joy is a rebellion against this idea of, you always say hockey stick, you know, that ever upward profit margin that is just completely unrealistic. And continuing to think that we can optimize and efficiency out and do all of this to people is completely unrealistic and far more unhinged than the idea of joy at work. And so if we can start to remember that and have our own joy, we actually become more productive. We actually become more engaged. We have more sense of belonging. And so if we push back on that as leaders and say, do we really need to make 1% more profit, or can we invest in our people a little bit that ultimately will get us 5% more profit according to the ROI research? So that's the second aspect of that question that's on a bigger level.
Well, and I feel like one of the things that you also really kind of hone in on is this need to kind of reshape and rewrite the stories that we tell ourselves. So a lot of us get stuck in these sort of, well, that's the way it's always been. Like, that's the way we've always done it. Like these sort of frozen in place, quite frankly, like stories about maybe we've worked in an industry a long time, or we've done a certain job in a certain role for a long time. And one of the topics that you sink into a lot is really focusing on, well, is that true? Are those stories that you're telling yourself, are they even true? And how are they shaping you? How are they shaping you as a leader? How are they shaping your abilities? How are they shaping your outcomes? And so for someone out there who's listening, who is thinking like, yeah, in 2026, or as you know, we come into this new year, I want to buy this book and I want to sit down and I want to rewrite, you know, the story that I'm going into the new year with. What would you like, what's the best advice that you would sink into with that person?
Well, I think first of all, the idea that the stories that we tell ourselves are both individual and cultural. And we have old, old stories for ourselves. Like one of my biggest fears, tomorrow is my book launch party. One of my biggest, oldest stories is I'm going to throw a party and no one's going to show up. You know, like it's an old story.
Everyone has that story, I think.
Like, oh my gosh. You know, like that is my story and I have to manage that. That's an individual story. And then we have these cultural stories that are a little bit about like what Justin's talking about in his comment. There's five people around them that don't want to be joyful because they're believing these myths. And in one of the early chapters of the book, I talk about the five blockers. There's these five roadblocks that we have to joy. One of them is the one that you talked about. This is the way it's always been. And I just call it tradition. You know, we're like, well, this is the way it's always been. So this is the way we have to do it. Except since the last time you changed something, you know, like we don't have to always do it that same way. We have this story that objectivity and measurement is the height of logic and how we should run a business. And people misquote Edward Deming all the time, saying, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. Except he never said that. He said, there are so many things that leaders have to manage that you cannot measure. And so these stories that are cultural, we also have to rewrite for ourselves. And so I think if you are thinking about, okay, I want to have more joy in my life today and cultivating that over time, which is a little bit of the question of how do you start this journey of joy if you're not as far along and settled in joy? First, let's define the parts of joy define what joy is. So if I can get more words out, the professional speaker that I am. So I say that there are three components to joy. There are three parts of it. One of it is that you feel lucky or favored or fortunate. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I get to do this. Like, this is the part of my job that I love. Like, I love it. That's one thing. Like, they wouldn't even, don't tell my boss, but you wouldn't have to pay me. Like, this isn't the part I love. I mean, I'm going to have you pay me, but like, oh my gosh, I love it. So the second thing is that whatever that part is that your activity or you're doing gives you a sense of belonging. Like you are connected to other people or you feel connected when you're doing that. That sense of belonging is and connection to others is a key part of joy. And then the third thing is what the purpose is of the work. So Jade Simmons, who is a brilliant keynote speaker and fantastic, she's a lovely friend. She says that purpose isn't what you do. Purpose is what happens in other people when you do what you do. So what is the impact of your work on other people? So if you've got those three things, you feel favored or fortunate, you feel like you belong and you're connected, and it benefits other people, something greater than yourself. You have to define that. So these stories that are coming at you, like, oh, this is the way it's always been. We got to measure it. Work before play and these other things. Before you can counteract those stories, you have to know what joy is for yourself. What are those things in your life that bring those things to you inside and outside of work? And you'll find that there's a connection. I didn't fight with my publisher, but we had a discussion.
A lovely in-depth discussion
in my car, in the van, on a Zoom call about the subtitle of the book, because how to cultivate intense happiness in work and life makes it seem like life and work are separate, and they're not. And I get SEO and how subtitles work, so I agreed. However, I address in the very beginning of the book, I know this is what it says, but you live one continuous life. So where you're experiencing joy can impact and does impact everything. Your home life impacts work and your work life impacts home. You live one continuous life. It's all together. And so those stories of joy, the places where you feel like you have those three things, that's going to go from one to the next. And identifying that and clarifying that for yourself is absolutely the first step. I've got a tool, if you're interested, I can tell you how to get it, that helps you figure that out.
Yes, I think people want to know.
So it's called the Joyosity Explorer Map. How do I get to you? It's jenwhitmer.com/explorermap, Joyosity Explorer. I will make sure
we can drop the link in.
I wasn't expecting to share that, but it's totally free. You can get it. If nothing else, just shoot me a DM and I will get it to you. But it helps you identify what are the things that bring me joy? What are these components that I have? Because you can't rewrite a story without rewriting in truth. You've got to rewrite in truth. And so you've got to know what those things are for yourself.
Totally. And I think to answer, you know, you answered it a little bit, but I wanted to go back to Lillian's question here about, you know, helping those that are also on the journey when you're not fully completed with the journey yourself. I think I just want to say, number one, I think we're never fully there. I feel like there is like a foreign concept. Like one day when I get there, then everything will be like unicorns. And I've never found the unicorn land. I don't know if anybody else has, but like, I don't know if there's like a mystical there land. What I would say to that also, I wanted to address it because it made me think. You had a podcast episode, I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. So it was before Thanksgiving. And you touched on Elizabeth Gilbert, who I love. And she had a great podcast that she did. I want to say it was back in like 2016 or maybe even 2015. It was a while ago, called Big Magic. Uh-huh. And she only did one season or maybe two seasons, and then she never did it again. I still, to this day, share that podcast with people, even though it is literally probably almost a decade old at this point, maybe a little less than that. Because that, and I say all that, Lillian, because like, I'm certainly not in the mythical there land, but I think you can help people, whether it's sending a podcast episode or, you know, gifting people the Joyosity book or, you know, whatever that looks like. I think you can help people along the way. Like, don't let that stop you of like, oh, well, I'm not there. I'm not on the other side. Therefore, I can't reach my hand back and like help somebody else. I think we're all on this like messy floating rock in the middle of space together. So as much as you can help other people, like you should.
Absolutely. And I think, Lillian, it's a great question. And I appreciate the vulnerability, like recognizing, oh my gosh, I'm not there yet, but yet then still the desire to help other people. I am not there. Like there is no there. There isn't. It's a little bit like eating. We don't go like, okay, I don't have to eat anymore. Fantastic. Don't have to breathe anymore. It's that's why I say cultivating. It is a work of cultivating. And it also begs the question of like, am I just supposed to be happy all the time? That's just unhinged. Like you, and our bodies physically can't handle it. Like our neurobiology would implode if we were at the high level of joy all the time. And as I dug into this research, I really wanted to figure out, okay, how do we experience enough joy to get all these great benefits? Like you're 3.5 times more likely to help other people. If one person on your team is experiencing joy, the rest of the team is 25% more productive. Like all of this good joy work, how do we get there? What's the formula? Because while I don't think that everything has to be measured, we do like some measurements to grab onto. And one of the things I discovered was what I've kind of dubbed the joy ratio. So if you are experiencing joy 35% of the time in your life, so you've got 35% of your work is joy, 35% of the entirety of your life. But if we just think about work, if 35% of your week is spent in that favored or fortunate, connected and belonging, purposeful, got 35% of your time. And then at the other end is toil. It's not, the opposite of joy isn't work. The opposite of joy is toil. And that's work that feels totally meaningless. It is boring. It's the stuff that you're not resourced for, or maybe you used to love it and you don't anymore. Like the constant joke in my house is, oh, it's a spreadsheet. Like some people love spreadsheets. It's not my favorite. Oh, not me. And so keeping those types of activities under 10%, I call it toil's tiny 10. So in this ratio, if you're 35% of my time, I'm trying to live in the space of joy, and then less than 10% of my time is spent in true toil, you will have, well, 55% in the middle. 55% in the middle is this messy middle stuff that we're always, always dealing with. And that ratio is really fluctuates seasons of your life. When my kids were, I was just talking, to Natasha about when my kids were 3 and 1, I wanted to stab my eyes out. That was not a season where, I mean, I had to keep, toil was a lot. Now that my kids are, in their teens and 20s, it's a different season of my life. When I was in the depths of writing the book, I loved writing. In the depths of marketing the book is not my favorite. And so those types of things, you have seasons, but if you can keep yourself in that 35% is joy and 10%, less than 10% is toil, that's the journey. That's the work that we're doing. And that's why it's ongoing all the time.
Well, and one of the things that you have in the book, I'm not sure if you've put it on LinkedIn or anything yet. I haven't seen it if you have, but you have this diagram and it talks about play. And that really stood out to me because I feel like when adults see the word play, immediately they're like, play is for children. Like, I know play. I'm a serious business lady or like businessman. And so obviously you go into a ton of companies and organizations and executive teams and do workshops. And I'm curious, has play been something that you've gotten a lot of pushback about or something that people that are in more corporate settings struggle with?
Yes. And usually, especially if I'm doing a workshop, and I tell a story in the book, in the chapter on play about this, that I usually begin a workshop with an activity. And it starts with, okay, stand up and we're going to make a circle. And like, there are the people who are like, oh, good, great. We're not going to sit all day. Fantastic. And then there are the people who are like, oh my gosh, it's
no,
forced fun. And I don't say that it's going to be fun. I don't call it a game. I call it an activity. And usually what happens, I would say actually 99.9% of the time in my experience, I can't remember the 0.1%. So that people start to loosen up and we do this activity and I ask them a lot of questions. And there is a place for play for no purpose. That is part of what play is. But when I'm doing a workshop, I feel the need to add some purpose to it so people understand why we're doing it. And so I explain the concepts of like, what did you feel? Why did this matter? And here's why that matters to what we're going to do today, and like draw those connections. And then people start to really open. It's almost like a breaking open of something. I don't want to call it an icebreaker, but like, it does do it. It is, does warm up the room. It breaks something open. And I asked this guy who runs a large manufacturing company outside of Chicago. So all of the stereotypes you want to add to that, he fits. And he was kind of the cross-armed, like, oh, great, we're going to stand up guy at the beginning of this activity. And I asked him, did you feel childish or childlike? And he stopped and he was like, I think at first I felt childish and then I felt childlike. And the childlike space is curiosity. It is wonder. It is the power of creativity. Childish is behaviors that are whiny, that are bossy, that are controlling and tantrums. And we see those from adults in the workplace still.
And 100%.
You know, like, so play actually brings us into the childlike space that is when companies talk about, we need more innovation. Well, then you need to play. And so there's a lot more in the book around the research behind that. But that's why play matters so much. And so I think there's always a little bit of pushback, but play changes us in a way that very few other things can.
What are one or two ways that someone who's listening today is like, okay, I like this idea of play. I think I want to either test something out. Again, could be in the workplace, could be at home, you know, mm-hmm. with kids or a partner or something like that. But like, what are one or two, you know, maybe it's questions or maybe it's activities or things that you think would be good for them to kind of give like a trial run to when it comes to play?
Well, I think the first thing is there is this idea of a playful approach, that a play is not game. Like we have like play game, you know, like it's not Scrabble or Boomerang, which is actually one of my favorite games, but it's not a game. A playful approach lets us, let's play with this a little bit. We talk about playing with language, or at least I do as a writer and a keynote speaker, I talk about playing with a language. Well, let's play with this idea for a little bit, even just like using the word play. Like you do, this is something you do really well, Kim, is you use the word curious when you ask a question, and just using the word curious opens up curiosity. Just like using the word play opens up a play. Okay, well, this doesn't feel as serious. There's not as much risk attached, even though play is a little risky. There is a component of that. So even just trying that out, what if we played with this for 5 minutes rather than that, like, okay, we have to find the answer and everybody buckles down and gets really stressed. Let's just, can we play with this for 5 minutes? Like set a timer. And then people, because then they're like, well, how long? And they ask all these questions and everybody gets freaked out. And start small. Can we play with this for a little bit? Okay.
I love the idea of a timer, because I think for like the control freaks, the type A's in the room, that always makes us feel good when we know like, okay, we're about to do something uncomfortable, but I only have to do it for, you know, 5 minutes. Because to me, it's a lot like going to the gym. You know, I resist it. And then I tell myself, you only have to go to the gym for 10 minutes. And normally once I'm there and it hits 10 minutes, I'm like, all right, let's just keep going on the elliptical, or, you know, whatever it is, I'll end up doing, you know, a 20 or 30 minute workout. Whereas before I wasn't even going to go at all. So I love that idea of kind of setting a time limit around play and then saying we only have to do this amount, but you know, maybe if everybody's kind of getting into it, yeah, we can keep it going.
And you've reached the goal. So there's a feeling of accomplishment because we did it for 5 minutes. So that is the, oh, yes, the improv people know the yes and. It's actually definitely one of the activities we do around conflict resolution. It's very fun. So you can also bring in activities that just open people up. One of the things that I think is very playful and low risk is to either put Post-it notes out or Play-Doh. Or I have like little fidgets. I often bring like little puzzles, like little squares that are half inch squares. And it's just something for people to mess with. I keep a bag of Legos by my desk. I learned this from my friend Leo Chan, who's a Lego series play expert. And if I can't figure something out, I start building it with the Legos. And that actually changes your brain chemistry. We have play circuits in our brain. Who knew? And they connect the front of our brain, which is all of the time management and strategy stuff, to all of the emotions and other like more basic functions of our brain in the back, and it connects them. So you're experiencing the world and doing it strategically at the same time. So little things like that, if you put Post-its out with like colored pencils, people tend to start to just doodle. And that's enough. That's enough. That is a low bar. In the book, I go into your play style because there's actually a play style that's like a personality. I actually was a little delusional and wrote a companion workbook to go with Joyosity.
We love overachievers.
Overachiever, delusional, who knows? But in the playbook, I have a whole section on how you identify your play style and actually how that changes your work, like why your play style connects to your work, not just having Post-it notes out, but if you are like, I'm an explorer, what that means for the way that I approach work. And so there are all kinds of different ways, but start with the low bar, just least viable thing and get trying.
And I would clarify, notice that Jen said things like, you know, pens, Post-its, Legos. This is not like, oh, I'm going to go play Candy Crush for 5 minutes on my phone. Get the phones out of here. We are talking about good old fashioned fun and play. No screen required. I just wanted to add that because I feel like sometimes when you say to people like, oh, 10 minutes of free time, they're like, you know, Instagram, TikTok. Yeah. And it's like, no, that's not what we're talking about here. Different. I love your point about really kind of framing that playful. One of the things that I actually do with my nephew, he is 11. And when he comes over for dinner, I feel like it kind of gets into the, how is school? How's soccer going? You know, and these kids, all their answers are the same. Fine. You're a loser. Stop talking to me. And I, one, it makes me depressed because I'm like, I am not a loser. I am very cool. Like, you should recognize that your aunt is a cool lady. So one of the things that I try to do with him is kind of get into that play and try things out on him by saying, I'm going to ask you three really weird questions about school today. And it sort of games him up of like, ooh, it's weird. Like, what are we asking about? And then I'll just make up with something silly like, you know, what's the grossest thing that you saw today? Or what's the funniest thing that happened in class today? And it just kind of makes him stop and think a little bit, because I find that a lot of times also we don't even get to the play part because we have these like rote answers or like, you know, prepared answers. How's it going? Fine. How's your day? Good. Mm-hmm. How'd you sleep? Great. You know, you just kind of, you don't actually stop and say like, well, did I sleep great? Actually, no. Slept like crap. Like you're just, you have to get out of that, I guess, autopilot that then auto answers these questions.
And that's what play does. That is what play does. It breaks you out of the mundane. And we call that a rut for a reason. We call it stuck for a reason. And so those two things, like telling him you're going to do it and then asking something off the wall, is what breaks us out. And I mean, Vanessa Van Edwards talks about that. And when she's like, I learned this from her, that what are you excited about this week is a very different question, because we're like, oh, excitement. There's one of the components of play is novelty. So we're like, oh, there's a novel aspect of that that redirects our interest. And that's not just something that's fun. It actually is productive, because when you break out, that is when you get the energy boost again. That is when you come up with a new idea. That's when you come up with a new angle. All these words that we like to use, the way you get there is joy and play.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's why everybody says, like, oh, this, you know, the idea hit me in the craziest of ways, or, you know, the idea came to me in the craziest of places. Yeah. Which, you know, to kind of bring it full circle, really, if we do want our workplaces or our businesses or our consulting work to grow, to thrive, to make more revenue, to push the boundaries, you have to introduce that play. If there is a direct correlation of, like, you want to make more revenue, well, then you got to bring in more great ideas. How are we bringing in great ideas? By bringing in joy and bringing in play and bringing in curiosity. And so I just really love the through thread that you tie throughout the book of how these aren't separate goals. They're actually all one and the same.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, like, the subtitle of my podcast is Creating Positive Culture with Complex People. And what we want to do in our hyper-productive, profit-centered, productivity-idled space is take out the complexity and let's just make everything a checkbox. Did we check the boxes? Did we do the things? Did we CYA? And we want to reduce humanity to an algorithm or a checklist. And that's never going to be possible with humans. And you work with humans every day. And Amanda, her best ideas come from walking in nature, because we live in the world and we're humans and connected with that. And so that is why all these interconnected ideas, in some ways, I was really nervous because the book is a little bit longer than a typical, sorry, I'm laughing at Jeff, the tree hugger here. I love it. I was nervous because it's a little bit longer than a traditional business book. I mean, my first draft, friends, was twice as long. So we did a good job editing. God bless editors. But it's because I wanted to give the fullness of what you will need, a toolbox of what you will need to cultivate joy in the real world, because you can't absorb it all at one time. So while the book will give you what you need for right now, it'll also give you what you need for later, for dealing with the complex human that you are and the others that you work with.
Oh, no, 1,000%. I feel like it really is a roadmap that you can have actionable steps at the end of each chapter to really start doing that in your everyday life, which is, I think, really helpful. And I always like better than sort of these esoteric books that you're like, you finish it and you're like, okay, that was great, but, like, how am I going to actually do that in my everyday life? So I was excited that you sort of added those in at the end of every chapter. And, you know, kind of going along that same thread, you know, we're big nerds here and we love homework and we love, you know, continuing to learn and getting things that we can continue to work on throughout the rest of the day or the weekend. And so I'm curious if you could give all of us a homework assignment for the rest of this week and going into this weekend. It could be to read something or download something or try something when it comes to really cultivating joy in ourselves, in others, in the workplace. What would be your homework assignment for us?
Oh, okay. So I think because I'm, as a former educator, I can't help it, I have a two-part homework assignment for you.
Love it.
I know. So the first one is, I would love for you to really set a timer, you know, for 10 minutes. It doesn't have to take long. Set a timer for 10 minutes, put your phone on do not disturb and put it away, and really sit down with pen and paper, pencil and paper, get a crayon, get a marker, whatever you love, a whiteboard, a post-it notes. Write down those three things. What do I love so much that I feel so lucky that I get to do that part of my job? Or in the rest of your life, if you don't want to do it just for work, you could do it for your whole life. What's the thing that I just love? It is like, oh my gosh, please don't ever take that part of my job away. Number two, what are the activities that I do that connect me to other people where I feel like I belong? I'm either creating belonging with other people, or I am, I, I, I feel like I belong. And then number three, what work really impacts other people? What is the work that I do? One time I was working with a financial institution and they're like, we just give people money. And I was like, you provide a way for somebody to have transportation to their job because not many people can just go pay cash for a car. Unfortunately, in our world, that's the way it is. You provide a home because a mortgage, people can't just flat out spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. But I have a place to live because you've provided a way to do that. That's purpose. So whatever your purpose is, my purpose is creating a joyful workplace. So people are whole, work is a joy, and organizations flourish. Like that changes communities and workplaces. So spend 10 minutes and just write down a few of those things. And, you know, bonus points, because we all love extra credit. Share, like make it a post, put it on LinkedIn, Instagram, tag Kim, tag Coffee with Kim, tag me. I'd love to see it. Spend those 10 minutes. So that's the first step. Step two is go buy the book, you know, because so jenwhitmer.com/books. You can get both Joyosity, the hardcover. You can get the playbook that is the companion workbook. They're both there for you. And I would love to hear what happens when you start to read it. I just think, I can't wait to hear how it impacts people and what they do with it.
Absolutely. And I love this point. Jim was like, homework? I thought we were supposed to play. And I Jeff came up with something that we should definitely trademark, which is joy work instead of homework, which is
every chapter. You know what there is? Joy work.
Joy work. Oh, Jeff. It's like you already knew what was going to happen. It's like you already knew what was going to happen. No, this has just been so wonderful and so great, Jen. Thank you so much for taking the time to come here and share this work with us. I know that it's something that you have been talking about for a long time and really helping others realize. And so I just want to say thank you for all the great work.
Oh, thank you. It is an honest statement that I would not be here without Coffee with Kim. So thank you for this work that you do every week. I have met literally the best people in the comments besides you and your team. And it's just, I would not be here without you. So thank you.
Well, I say all the time, like, this is my favorite day of the week. Like, this is like the best thing. So going back to your point earlier of like, what's that thing that you're like, I would do it for free. Like, don't tell anybody. I'm like, this, like people all the time are like, but it's so much work. And I'm like, it's the best thing. It's the best thing. It's the best work. I'd do it 1,000 times over again. So your work so deeply resonates with me, Jen. And I can't wait for everybody else to get their hands on this book. I can't wait to gift it to some people and some, it won't fit in a stocking. So it will just have to be next to the stocking. But I am excited to gift it out for Christmas because I think it's just something that is really something that we all need a lot of right now and that we all need to bring into 2026. So I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you guys for all being here, Jim and Amanda and Rachel and Aaron and Jeff and James and Andy. And I just feel like Justin, we had such great questions today. I tried to get to all of them. If I missed any, you can message Jen or me directly and we'll make sure to get you those answers. Like I said, we'll include the link for Jen's book in the show notes and in the chat so you can always have that handy. And we will see you next Wednesday, same time, same place. You can head to getcoffeewithkim.com and we'll, you know, send you a little calendar invite and all that good stuff. So never fear, we are always here. So thank you guys so much and we'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.
Bye.
Whew, that was some good stuff. Thanks for being a part of this week's Coffee with Kim. If podcasts are your thing, subscribe to the show and you'll see a new episode appear next week in your favorite listening app. If you want to be a part of the conversation, join us live on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern over on LinkedIn. You can RSVP at getcoffeewithkim.com. I want you to have your questions answered because why should I get to have all the fun? And let's be honest, you know how to ask some hard-hitting questions. My guests and I cannot wait to meet you. See you soon.